Not here this week.
Yes, she is on the Tesla car in space.
She's on the Tesla car in space.
Yes.
So
she'll be back hopefully.
Hopefully be back next week. She's very busy. We love her and miss her. We have a really cool interview coming up with Zach Bornstein, who is a comedian and former SNL writer who wrote during the first year of the Trump White House. So we're going to be talking to him about comedy and politics and pretty much that's it. We'll explore that. I'm pretty excited about this interview.
Yeah, it's going to be a different little tone for
Pod, yeah, you know? Yeah. A little bit of, we were talking levity, because oftentimes we are interviewing about such serious topics. So, but we do have to talk about serious things, and unfortunately we have to cover yet again another school shooting. This happened in Florida this week. It's so much. Mm-hmm.
It gets disheartening because we find ourselves recycling the same speeches about these things. And, you know, when it comes to security of our kids, and, you know, every time we say, you know, like if it wasn't the Sandy Hook elementary school students, if it's not these high school students, you know, like why are we not doing the necessary steps to ensure the safety of the future of this country?
Yeah.
You know,
I will say that, you know, I was also, I didn't have a lot of confidence in what was, I mean, after Sandy Hook, when nothing got done, I didn't have any confidence in things getting done this time. And it's horrible and it's sad and I want things to change and we need gun reform in this country. But the students at this high school have changed things. Mm-hmm. I really believe this, and I think it's amazing what they're doing, and we wanted to highlight some of these students. Day one, I mean, of this happening, they were a lot of them were on the news. Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I would not have been as eloquent of a speaker at 17, going through that much trauma. But they're kids, and they're out talking about it, and they're on Twitter, and they're taking to social media, and they're saying, no, now is the time. Because, you know, Paul Ryan, Trump, a lot of the GOP say, oh, this is not the time, this is not the time, let's wait a couple days, right. And then it always gets pushed under the rug. But these guys are saying, no, let's talk about it right now. I was shot at.
Yes.
And Emma Gonzalez gave a speech recently. She was one of the students at the high school that was attacked, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. And the New York Times covered this, and they covered a lot of these students, and they wrote that Emma Gonzalez leads a student outcry on guns, and they quoted her saying, this is the way I have to grieve. This is an article from Julie Turkowitz, Matt Steves, and Jason M. Bailey, where they write, at the federal courthouses here on Saturday, students, including many of the very people who had to endure the trauma of a shooting on campus, continued to speak out about guns. Since Wednesday, when a gunman killed 14 students and three staff members at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, their youthful voices have resonated where those of longtime politicians have largely fallen flat. Speaking publicly at the rally, Emma Gonzalez, a senior, pledged that her school would be the site of the nation's last mass shooting. How could she know? Because she said she and her peers would take it upon themselves to change the law. They say they want tougher gun laws. They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS. She continued as a chorus of supporters echoed her. They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS. They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call BS. They say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS. That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS.
That's incredibly profound.
If you have a chance to watch the video, you should. Go to the New York Times article. They have it. Or just YouTube Emma Gonzalez. I think it's amazing what these students are doing.
There, I remember a couple interviews also on CNN. I saw a couple, I think, on MSNBC as well. That these students, just in candid interviews with reporters anyway, these are some of the most strong-willed 17-year-olds I've ever seen.
Ever.
You know, ever. Like, they, you know, they, and like looking directly into the camera and calling out the president, you know, saying, you need to do something about this. Like, that's some gumption and that's some courage. And I wish our Congress had that same that same tenacity that these kids have.
You know, for all the criticizing that our generation and now the younger generation endures, I can't wait. I can't wait to see the next level of leaders, because clearly we've been failed by the current group.
Yep.
So I can't wait. So we were talking about, the gumption and the movement of a lot of these students. There was another one that I thought was kind of amazing. His name is David Hogg. And he writes for the school newspaper at Major E. Stoneman Douglas, and he recorded students' thoughts of the school of guns in America, basically during the school shooting. So he's sitting there in a classroom, everyone's down on the ground, you know, lights are off, and he's recording students' reactions to guns in America while it's happening. Somebody tweeted out the video and they said, someone give this kid a Pulitzer Prize. I agree.
Yeah.
If you want to check it out, type in student reporter interviews classmates hiding from gunman in Florida high school. It's from the StarTelegram.com, star-telegram.com. David Hogg, one of the students, recorded this. I mean, where are these kids coming from?
Yeah, I always talk about the negative aspects of social media, being that because you're behind a screen, you're a lot more courageous to say certain things without the repercussions. But I think you have to see the other side of that too, meaning these people do feel emboldened enough to be like, hey, I will stand up to this. I will call this out. And so I think we're seeing the positive side of social media, where these kids are saying like, yeah, we can speak out. I will tweet it out to, I don't care if I have 500 followers or 5,000. I want these people to know that we're not standing for this. I've seen a lot of them call out like, you've messed with the wrong kids. We are not going to, be the generation that just gets killed off like this. Mm-hmm. I was going to make a point, but we're going to get to it in a second. I do want to talk about one thing though, and that's, the blame that gets thrown around, because you've noticed that this administration within this last couple of days has said things like, oh, well, the students should have done more. You know, there should have been
guns.
Which
is appalling.
There should have been this. You know, like, I don't think we talk about like not trying to throw blame at things, but I think there are some steps that the FBI missed, because we could go into details about how this kid was, he was on their radar. He had been reported. Police had been to the family's house at least 50 times. Yeah. There were signs there, yes, but do not blame these kids at all.
No.
And also, Trump himself, he ended a rule to block the mentally ill from getting guns.
Yeah.
So,
and the GOP, I think this is important to bring up too, because the GOP makes it a mental health issue every time there's a gun attack in America. They say, mental health is the issue. Mental health is the issue. There is a mental health problem in this country. Mm-hmm. We need to do a better job about addressing that. Veterans with PTSD, we need to talk about mental health in general, the overdrugging of the American population. That's a conversation we need to have. Yeah. But this is a guns problem.
Yeah.
This is a guns problem in America. And for Trump to say that it's a mental health issue, when in fact that he ended a rule to block the mentally ill from getting guns, is astounding.
Yes. And so it's constantly pointing a mirror back at itself.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump does it almost every day at this point. This is an article from ABC News by Alyssa Weiserama.
Weiserama,
sorry, I can't read. nearly a year ago on February 28th, 2017, President Trump signed HJ Res 40, which effectively ended the Social Security Administration's requirement to enter the names of people who receive mental health benefits into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. That's a database used by the FBI to determine who is able to purchase firearms. According to estimates from the previous administration, had the Obama-era regulation gone into effect, an estimated 75,000 individuals with mental illnesses would have been added to that database. These individuals would have been notified by the Social Security Administration of their possible restrictions to buy firearms, but would have had the opportunity go through an appeal process. So it's like we had steps in place to make sure things like that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, we had a ton of steps in place for a ton of things, and then Trump doesn't like Obama, mm-hmm. and now here we are.
And then he still found, like the other day, he found time just to say, the FBI wasn't so busy looking into the fake Russia scandal, they would have found this.
He's a vile, vile man.
This is terrible. Like, don't. And I think someone literally replied, how fucking dare you?
Yeah.
Which I agree.
It's absurd. Well, he's a monster. He's truly a monster. And to highlight the hypocrisy, the continued hypocrisy, Bess Kalb, who is a writer at Jimmy Kimmel, I follow her on Twitter. She's awesome. She's been calling out a bunch of people. She actually started up a drive for Everytown, and I think she said for every donation, she would donate $5. And I donated $25. I recommend, and we'll talk about this in a second, but she does amazing, amazing work. And she got on Twitter, and she responded to tweets from multiple GOP lawmakers expressing their thoughts and prayers after the shooting by tweeting the amount of money they have taken from the NRA, which I think is fantastic. That was from a Hill article from Rebecca Savronsky. And they have the tweet here where she said, "God have mercy on your NRA-kept souls." And she tweeted that Richard Burr has received $6.9 million from the NRA. Roy Blunt, who is the senator from Missouri, has received $4.5 million. Tom Tillis, who is North Carolina, is 4.4. Cory Gardner, who is Colorado, is 3.8. Marco Rubio, who is from Florida, is 3.3. Joni Ernst, who is from Iowa, is 3.1. Rob Portman from Ohio is 3 million. And Todd Young from Indiana is 2.8. And Bill Cassidy from Louisiana is also 2.8. So I also named all those senators without anything telling me where they're from. So
just want
to pat myself on the back with that one. I've been doing the Sporkle Senator quiz.
Ah.
I can name 97 out of 100. There's just a couple of those guys that are like, "What? Who are you?" Like Dan Sullivan. He's a senator from Alaska.
Oh, yeah, Dan.
Who
oh,
is
man.
That?
He's next door. What would?
he's
your neighbor.
Oh, no.
So, guys, so here's
that's,
the big thing.
There's millions of dollars. Sorry.
No, you're right.
It's millions of dollars to the NRA.
It is an ongoing fight with the NRA. We've talked about this ad nauseum. But there are ways to get involved. And, you know, as we talk about with, you know, every week, you know, it's little by little, but a movement works and we mm-hmm. have to make things heard. And again, going to these students, they're organizing a student walkout. So right now it's planned to be on April 20th.
Okay, cool.
Students are wearing orange, which is also happens to be the color of anti-gun violence.
Oh, fantastic.
So right now that's how it stands. They have a Twitter account. It's twitter.com/studentswalkout. So just make sure you visit there. It's run by a student in Connecticut, I believe.
Okay.
Go ahead and just visit that. They'll probably update you more as time goes on. If you can organize something in your hometown, let's try to make this a nationwide movement.
Yeah.
And really bring some attention to the fact that these are our kids' lives and they don't need to go to school fearing that they won't come back.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So check out, yes, Students Walkout on Twitter. There's also Everytown.
Remember, Everytown.
Yes, you can always donate to Everytown. Remember our interview with Jennifer Hoppe and MomsDemandAction.org?
Yeah.
Go back to the interview and we'll talk all about common sense gun reform because we absolutely need it in this country.
Yeah. And also, yeah. Just a note, and I think we talked about this. I don't know if this was the Jennifer Hoppe episode, but I remember you and I covered this. For everybody that says that you can't do anything about guns, remember Australia had a mass shooting about 20 years ago, and then they introduced a buyback program, and they bought guns off of everybody in the country. Hundreds of thousands of guns. The government bought them back. Do you know how many mass shootings have happened in Australia since that? Zero.
Zero. And we've had how many in America just in 2018 alone?
Like I don't know. Over 10, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's like 8. Isn't it like 18, I think?
Yeah.
Like? Yeah, it's like 18. And we haven't even gotten through February.
We're in the middle of February.
18 school shootings it's since the beginning of the year. So we're definitely doing something wrong, and we need to
something
fix that.
Can be done.
Yes.
And so we're going to move into Russia, and I think this is kind of a nice transition. I mean, it's not a nice transition, but it's a transition.
But unfortunately, they go hand in hand.
Yeah. So with the school shooting, this is from a Hill article by Max Greenwood. Russian bots flood Twitter with pro-gun messages after Florida shooting. You know, because there is truly no depth to which Russia can go, apparently, and the GOP right behind. A day after the deadly school shooting in South Florida, Twitter saw a spike in tweets about gun violence from Russian-linked accounts. Hamilton 68, which is a program we have talked about, you should definitely check out. Google Hamilton 68. It's a website that tracks Twitter accounts linked to Russian influence campaigns, identified trending hashtags and topics on Thursday, including hashtag Parkland, hashtag Gun Control Now, hashtag Florida, and hashtag Gun Control, as well as Nicholas, the name of the accused shooter. We don't want to say his full name. He doesn't deserve that. Another website run by Robot Labs, botcheck.me, which tracks political propaganda bots, found that of all the top two word phrases used on Twitter in the day after the shooting, excluding President Trump's name, had to do with the attack, according to Wired. Botcheck.me does not only track bots linked to Russian influence campaign, And Ashbot, one of the project's founders, told Wired that he would not speculate who was operating the accounts that his website tracks. This is more of the Russian disinformation campaign, and we have seen this with the election. What they do is find nerves in America that split polarizing issues, and then they hit on those nerves, and they're using, frankly, children being shot to death as a way to divide the American public on guns. Mm-hmm. So it is important to be informed about this. Hamilton 68 is a wonderful, wonderful tool to see what they're talking about and how they are trying to drive division within our country.
And it's just what scares me is how easily it's done. Because you know,
this
even,
is social media being used for bad.
Because circling back to the election of Donald Trump, you know, right after that happened, you know, Russian bots were able to organize both rallies to support Trump and rallies to protest his election.
Right, and we're going to get into that now.
Which is why this is a big deal. Because so, a Russian troll farm, 13 suspects were indicted in 2016 election interference. Washington Post article by Devlin Barrett, Sari Horowitz, and Rosalind S. Helderman.
We love Rosalind.
What up, Ros? So the Justice Department's special counsel announced a sweeping indictment Friday of a notorious Russian group of internet trolls, charging 13 individuals and three companies with a long-running scheme to criminally interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. So the Internet Research Agency, or IRA from here on out, based in St. Petersburg, was named in the indictment as the hub of an ambitious effort to trick Americans online into following and promoting Russian-fed propaganda that pushed 2016 voters toward then-Republican candidate Donald Trump and away from Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. The indictment charges that the Russian efforts began in 2014 when three of the Russian conspirators visited 10 states, gathering intelligence about U.S. politics. Officials say that there are, as operations progressed, the suspects also engaged in extensive online conversations with Americans who became unwitting tools of the Russian efforts. The indictment does not accuse the Russian government of involvement in the scheme, nor does it claim that it succeeded in swaying any votes. But here's that word unwitting, though. Here's why I love that, because there's, I believe there's a there was a bot account called, it was Tennessee GOP. I think the actual account was like 10_GOP.
Uh-huh.
And guess who was retweeting a lot of their messages? Donald Trump Jr.,
yeah.
Kellyanne Conway.
Sure.
All right. So I wonder if they're considered the unwitting tools in that, because it's just so.
Trump Jr. certainly is a tool.
And he's definitely a tool, but he's the first person to like retweet a bunch of those. Because we talked about that with the, I think the WikiLeaks thing a couple weeks ago, how. Mm-hmm. He was talking to someone in the emails. About 15 minutes later, his dad then tweets something about it.
Yeah, they're not unwitting tools.
You know,
there's been clear evidence, and we'll talk about this more too, of Russian involvement in the election and how it swayed it towards Donald Trump. They're not unwitting. If they're unwitting, I mean, who could possibly believe the sheer amount of coincidence? This isn't like a Meg Ryan movie.
Right.
You know, this is the government. A hostile foreign government influencing our election very clearly. The one, and I will say this comes up in the article. They also helped the Bernie campaign, and we do have to bring that up. That's a different case. We don't know if the Bernie campaign. I highly doubt the Bernie campaign was a witting accomplice of Russian disinformation and influence. I think that has been another tool to divide the Hillary and Bernie camp, frankly.
Well they did. It, I think it's mentioned somewhere in here that some of the bots had tried to sway minority voters into voting third party. So there was also that movement to try. And obviously they knew third party would hurt Hillary in the long run.
Right.
And so that's why, I mean, not to say that Bernie had tons of support. Many, many people wanted Bernie as their candidate.
Yeah.
But I think there was a push, especially by these Russian hackers, to try to get people to vote third party so that they could weaken Hillary's campaign.
Yeah, that's my point, is that there was such division already in the Democratic primaries that, of course, if you're trying to sow more division, you're going to support Bernie because it's just going to prolong it. I don't think that the Bernie campaign was a knowing accomplice. I truly believe in my bones that the Trump campaign knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
This is a takeover of our government. The president is probably a Russian spy. one of those indicted Friday was, his name is Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin, a well-known figure that the Russian news media has identified as the financial backer of the Internet Research Agency. He is a caterer who has been nicknamed Putin's chef because of his close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Concord Management and Consulting and Concord Catering, two Russian businesses also charged by Mueller's team Friday, previously have been identified as Prigozhin vehicles. Again, the sheer amount of coincidence. If you don't think anything about that, then I got a bridge to sell you because, wow. So we talked about this. So H.R. McMaster, who's the national security advisor to President Trump, said that the new round of indictments in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation show incontrovertible evidence that Russia meddled in the 2016 presidential election. This is from an article from The Hill by Brandon Carter. He was speaking at a Munich security conference on Saturday, and he said that with the FBI indictment, the evidence is now incontrovertible that Russia interfered in the election. In a tweet following the release of the indictments, Trump claimed that the indictment showed his campaign, quote, did nothing wrong, and there was, quote, no collusion with Russia. So this is Trump now going off message from his national security advisor. Everybody in the White House, everybody in the government knows that Russia meddled. Why? All these coincidences, and then Trump, of all people, says, nothing to see here. Why? Why do you think that is?
Do you ever think, like, because he's gone off message with just about everyone in his administration. So I just wondered, if you're that person he happens to just, like, go off message from, you just kind of sit there and be like, what the F, man?
Yeah, I think the whole White House. Do you ever, I love reading the juicy gossip. We don't talk about it here because, you know, you can, if you're listening, you should, if you want to read the juicy gossip, you can read the juicy gossip. We like to cover the big issues that are happening. Yeah. That being said, I love the juicy gossip. And all the time, everybody, all the sources in the White House, it's just, they always sound like they're so sad.
Right.
Because it's just a clusterfuck.
Because it's like having your friend, like you're just trying to cover for your friend. And be like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, he totally has a ticket. And they're like, yeah, I don't need a ticket. And you're like,
yeah. Trump is the drunk friend at the bar. And the administration, his White House administration, is the friend who's trying to calm him down. Mm-hmm. And the American people are the rest of the people at the bar that are like, you also need to go with your friend.
Yes.
Like just, you're just responsible. Stop trying to keep him calm in the bar. Leave the bar.
Hashtag get your friend. I'm very proud of myself for that one.
That was good. I think we've had two moments where we've really highlighted today. We've really shown our light. I watched the whole first season of Queer Eye and I'm feeling so inspired.
Oh my God. It's so good.
It's so good.
If you Netflix, everyone, go watch Queer Eye.
It truly is the antidote for 2018.
It really is.
I cried in every episode, except for the one about the stand-up comic, ironically.
Because did you see yourself in him? And then you're
No, not at all, frankly. Oh. Because I cried. He wasn't emotional at all. I'm a big crier.
I've never seen you cry in front of me.
I tear. I tear a lot. I don't like full cry, but I tear quite a bit. You ever watch videos of like soldiers coming home? Her engagement
soldiers
videos.
Coming home, but also like it's their pets. I mean, kids are cute, but like when their pets get really excited, I think.
Or the color when people put glasses on where they can see color for the first time,
or when they put an implant and they can hear for the first time.
Yeah, I cry.
So back to politics.
Watch them at work.
So Mueller levels new claim of bank fraud against Manafort. Surprise! It's a political article by Josh Gerstein.
Politico. Did you say political article?
I said political.
Oh, I thought you said political. I was like, they're all political articles.
I mean, sorry. Everything is. I know.
That's
So special counsel Robert Mueller's office has told a federal judge that it has found evidence that Paul Manafort, former Trump campaign chairman, committed bank fraud not addressed by the indictment last October, in which he was charged with money laundering and failure to register as a foreign agent. First of all, I'm just going to say, if you didn't label everything the first time, you done messed up, man. Because that's just...
Yeah.
Like, why would you just do it? Just lay it all out, because now you're in deep.
Well, it's because he's a skeevy man.
So as legal wrangling continues over a $10 million bail package for Manafort, prosecutors this week accused him of submitting false information to a bank in connection with at least one of his mortgages. No criminal charges are known to have been filed over the alleged fraud, and Mueller's office does not say in the filing whether it intends to bring any. But the filing in Mueller's office says Manafort obtained a mortgage using, quote, doctored profit and loss statements, overstating by millions of dollars the income for his consulting company, DMP International. Prosecutors appear to be referring to a $9.5 million mortgage that Federal Savings Bank of Chicago extended in late 2016 to a Manafort-linked firm, Summer Breeze, LLC.
Which is like, that's the name of a sailboat.
Right. Which I feel like, and like if you're watching, like I feel like this is like an 80s movie where like they like put it into, oh yeah, it's our special. Yeah, it's like, and it's like the most obvious name, so you know something is up.
Yeah, like what do we call it? And Manafort was like sipping a pina colada and he was like, summer breeze.
Gosh. So
I can't wait for Ray Liotta to play him.
There can be so many movies. Okay, there's going to be 3 Lifetime movies, mm-hmm. a USA special, mm-hmm. An American true crime story mm-hmm. on FX,
yeah.
and one movie. I'm out of this.
Ray Liotta has to play Manafort, and I truly, in my heart of hearts, believe this. Jim Carrey needs to play James Comey. I think it's the role of a lifetime. I think it's the role of a lifetime. He's proved he can handle drama. He's proved he can handle it.
Man on the Moon almost ruined him.
Yeah, he's not... Yeah, but that's because he was playing Andy Kaufman. James Comey is not like an absurdist comedian.
But no, I just don't think Jim Carrey wants to delve down that road. It could be a dark movie. Who's directing it?
David Fincher.
What?
Yeah, oh of course. God. He directed House of Cards. It's perfect.
I know, but
that's a perfect movie.
Can they still do asides like Frank used to do?
No.
Oh, come on.
No, you need to have it like The Social Network, like cool and silky. That's how I describe all of his work.
Hit the next one.
Okay. This is a CNN exclusive. A Trump campaign advisor close to a plea deal with Mueller. Former Trump campaign advisor Rick Gates is finalizing a plea deal with special counsel Robert Mueller's office, indicating he's poised to cooperate in the investigation, according to sources familiar with the case. Gates has already spoken to Mueller's team about his case and has been in plea negotiations for about a month. He's had what criminal lawyers call a queen for a day interview, in which a defendant answers any questions from the prosecutor's team, including about his own case and other potential criminal activity he witnessed. Once a plea deal is in place, Gates would become the third known cooperator in Mueller's sprawling probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. This is important. The queen for a day interview is a big deal. It just means that he's going to be able to talk about the crime or the crimes committed and potentially not be tried for them. And then he could become a cooperating part of the investigation. Mm-hmm. So that's important. You should know that. Let's move on to general fuckery.
Yeah, just hit a couple points. So
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is under investigation for possible collusion with Sinclair Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai is being investigated by the FCC Inspector General over suggestions that he improperly scrapped regulations to help Sinclair Broadcast Group buy rival TV station operator Tribune Media. Rep. Frank Pallone, he's a Democrat from New Jersey, and 2 congressional aides told the New York Times on Thursday. This is from an article from The Week by Peter Weber. Last April, Pai pushed through the first of several regulatory changes that allow TV broadcasters to increase the number of stations they own. Sinclair, already the nation's largest TV broadcaster, would own 223 stations, reaching 72% of households if its $3.9 billion Tribune purchase goes through. Under the rules in place since the 1970s, broadcasters were limited to 39% of markets. Pai calls those rules outdated in the internet age.
I can't stand that, only because... First of all, he's terrible in his position, like literally the worst, and this FCC is terrible. But he also released a video trying to tell everyone that net neutrality is bad. And I'm like, yeah, at that point, you've lost me and I cannot by any means support you in anything you do. So this guy is just terrible. And I'm glad he's under investigation and I hope they bring the hammer down on him.
Yeah.
Quick thing. Trump is proposing to eliminate federal funding for PBS and NPR, which is asinine. This is a Hill article by Joe Concha. Trump's newly proposed budget includes a proposal to end federal funding for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, CPB, part of a package that includes $300 billion in new spending overall. CPB provides federal funding for PBS and National Public Radio stations. In March 2017, after the first Trump budget was proposed, eliminating the CPB, the 50-year-old nonprofit characterized itself as, quote, one of America's best investments. Quote, we will work with the new administration and Congress in raising awareness that elimination of federal funding to CPB begins the collapse of the public media system itself and the end of the essential national service, CPB President Patricia Harrison said. This is this is education. It's Sesame Street. It's access to information.
It's no money.
It's no money. And like, and they're saying like, oh, well, you guys, because I think their argument was that, well, you get a lot of crowdfunding anyway. You don't need federal money. First of all, if Trump stopped golfing, we'd have a lot more money.
Yeah, honestly.
Ugh. So let's just put that out there.
This was a big piece of news. We wanted to talk about. We're covering it kind of quickly, but This is another CNN exclusive from Jim Acosta. At least 100 White House officials served with interim security clearances until November, in which Acosta writes that nearly a year into President Trump's administration, senior-level staffers, including Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, and Rob Porter, remain on interim clearances, even as other senior advisors were granted full security access, according to information obtained by CNN from a U.S. government official. Having interim clearance can hamper a staffer's ability to perform essential functions of the job, a former administration official said. It requires those with full permanent clearances to remain vigilant about what information is shared with those still operating on an interim basis. There are more than 100 staffers in the executive office of the president who are operating on interim clearances more than a year after Trump was elected, according to the information. It's not clear which of those staffers gained full clearances in the 3 months since the information was produced in November. It is also unclear whether the delay is the result of a bureaucratic backlog or potential complications in the background of these aides. Some officials who started on January 20th, 2017 and were without permanent clearances by November include a special assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and the National Security Council's Senior Director for International Cybersecurity. Oh, God.
There's that dumpster fire just slowly moving over to the next dumpster and just getting bigger.
So you should know about that. It's terrible. Yes. Let's get to the good news. Before we go into our interview and our candidate to get excited about, we'll try and cover this in the next 2 minutes. We're going a little over. We're going into overtime for this interview.
Gosh.
But that's because we're just having some fun today.
So just real quick, Larry Krasner sues Big Pharma, drops all marijuana possession charges. This is a Philly Mag article by Joe Trinacria. All right. On the same day that Philly.com op-ed was published, in which Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner and Mayor Kenney admitted the failure that was the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s, the DA's office announced that it is suing 10 pharmaceutical companies in connection with the opioid epidemic and is dropping all outstanding marijuana possession charges.
This is what happens when you elect progressives.
Yes. And in just this little over a month since taking office, Krasner has already built on the progress that began under former Mayor Michael Nutter's administration by further reforming the city's drug policy to the point where getting busted with pot now no longer means a court date is in your future. Krasner says citations are issued approximately 90% of the time someone is caught with marijuana. I just love that they're realizing that you don't need to be incarcerated for marijuana charges. Like it's asinine to be doing that. Go after the pharmaceutical industry, who is unfortunately peddling out all these drugs as a solution to problems. The opioid epidemic is huge in our country right now, so I'm glad that someone is finally doing something about it where our administration is not.
Yeah. Great. So our candidate to get excited about, her name is Lisa Lucas. She is running for the West Virginia House to represent District 7. You might have heard her name in the news because she was recently thrown out of the state capitol in Charleston on Friday when she tried to testify against an oil and gas industry bill, HB 4268, that would allow companies to drill on minority mineral owners' land without their consent. This is from commondreams.org, where they talk that Lucas began to testify to the House Judiciary Committee, but a few minutes in, her microphone was turned off, and Lucas was dragged out of the room. She's quoted as saying, "As I tried to give my remarks at the public hearing this morning on HB 4268 in defense of our constitutional property rights, I got dragged out of the House of Chambers. Why? Because I was listing out who has been donating to delegates on the Judiciary Committee. I have to keep this short." This is quoting her from when she was talking, when she was in the Capitol. "I have to keep this short because the public only gets a minute and 45 seconds while lobbyists can throw a gala at the Marriott with whiskey and wine and talk for hours to the delegates." This is a real thing that she was referring to. It's called the Whiskey, Wine, and Policy Winter Legislative Reception at the Charleston Marriott Hotel, which happened on February 7th, sponsored by the Shale Energy Alliance.
That's the most pretentious title I've ever heard.
And then she started naming. She said, John Schott, First Energy, $2,000. Appalachian Power, $2,000. Steptoe & Johnson, that's a gas and oil law firm, $2,000. Consol Energy, $1,000. EQ2, $1,000. And I could go on.
EQT.
Oh, I'm sorry, EQT. And then she was thrown out. And she is running now to be to represent District 7, which always sounds so Hunger Gamesy,
right,
in West Virginia. And we wanted to look into her. If you want to know more about her, you can go to lisalucas.com. That's LISSALUCAS.com. You can donate to her campaign. She talks about budgeting, labor, our vision for West Virginia, political reform, substance abuse, constitutional rights, and then women's issues and men's issues, which I thought not a lot of people do, not a lot of people separate. And, you know, sometimes men are like, oh, well, if a woman's running for office, you know, all the bullshit men's rights things, mm-hmm, which she is not calling for. She's talking about in divorce proceedings, whether the main custodial parent gets to have access to the child and the non-custodial parent and what that means for raising the child. So she brings up a lot of really cool issues. Head to lisalucas.com. Get excited about that. Go to everytown.org if you want to get involved with the fight against gun violence, or momsdemandaction.org. Follow Students Walk Out on Twitter. Check out our interview with Jennifer Hoppe, who is the deputy director of Moms Demand Action. Check out Hamilton 68 if you want to see where the Russian robots are going. And go to Sporkle if you want to do that senator test. If you can get above me, I got 97. Tell us and we'll brag about you on air. And then check out Queer Eye because it's such a good show. We'll be right back with Zach Bornstein.
And we're back.
And we're back.
Oh, okay. I didn't. We just kind of jumped in. Yes. I feel like this is good because, like, this is kind of how comedy podcasts like.
Yeah. This start is our first foray into being a comedy podcast.
Yes.
Guys, welcome to the pod, Zach Bornstein.
Hello.
Former SNL writer, comedian, just dear friend. We love him very much.
Well, let's not.
Yeah.
All right.
I knew that would be immediately called into question. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks. I'm glad your Zoom is working.
It's working.
Yeah.
We were having some SD card issues.
Uh-huh. Right. And we don't have issues in here. We just talk about the issues.
We just chat and toss an onion up and down.
It is a lacrosse ball.
It really looks like an onion. Why are you peeling it then and giving a speech about ogres having layers?
Gosh.
Like a parfait.
So Zach, obviously we don't have to harp on this too much, but let's talk about just your time on SNL.
It was a very interesting time
because you were there for the first year of Donald Trump.
Yes.
And
the transition into him.
And the transition. So, you know, tell us a little bit what that's like, because, you know, though people might not be familiar with the writing process on SNL.
Sure.
But especially with Trump, where it seemed like every hour something happened.
Something
like
that.
We've got to talk about this.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Well, pretty much every cold open was about him. Yeah. And there usually was some pretty easy format, like the debates or, you know, a town hall that was going on that was easy that you could put all the jokes of that week into. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it was like pretty emotional at first. Like I remember the night we got elected, or he got elected, was me and him.
Whoa,
we got
what?
Uh-oh.
So you're the Russian.
Yeah, yes. I'm Dmitry Sokoros. It was the writing night for Chappelle's week, and it was Chappelle's big return to sketch comedy. And I was with him when Donald Trump got announced, and he was just like, "I told y'all, motherfuckers, this was gonna happen."
Oh my god!
And it was, everyone was sobbing, and it just like, it was like a bomb had gone off. Cause it was also weird. Cause that night there was a Hillary party in the, in like the ice skating rink outside of Rockefeller Center.
Like where she was going to go to do her speech.
I don't know if that's where maybe, I think.
Because she was in that. I had friends who were at the whatever the convention center was.
Oh, okay.
There's like pictures of them crying.
Yeah, that's like what. So her thing was closer, and then Trump's thing was just like five blocks north at this Hilton on 6th Ave. And so every time a state was announced, we would know who won based on if we heard a cheer that sounded close or a cheer that sounded distant.
That's
like if you
bizarre.
Heard like a. Yeah, it was like, yes, Hillary got whatever. And if you heard like a, it was like, fuck.
Oh my God.
No.
He got Florida.
That's horrifying.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, well, yeah, continue. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I have nothing. Go on.
I'm just so shocked.
So it was very emotional the next day. That night was crazy because all the material people were writing was about Clinton winning. Like I had written this sketch where it was like Obama going on this like kind of like victory tour by doing like a Def Jam comedy kind of like tour of America now that he doesn't have anything to promote. And there was these other really good sketches people were writing about, like doing like a ride along with Hillary and like what Trump was going to do. We were going to do this, like the whole slate of the Trump TV network and stuff like that. But then all of that got thrown out at like 2 a.m. and the show had to be rewritten through tears. And then the next morning at the table read, it just like had to go on and people are just sobbing at the table. Like
oh my God.
All the actors, the writers, producers, people are just like either just like steel-faced or just openly crying. And Lauren had to give a speech about like, you know, there's dark times in America and this has happened before. And we live in, there's two countries in this country. And, you know, we just, you know, we'll make it past. But, yeah. You know, they say the show goes on and stuff like that. And then Chappelle read this poem. I forget the exact, I know some people wrote it down, but he wrote this, he just read this very emotional poem and then just like let the silence exist. And then the, we just like went on and it was like, okay, open on farts. And, like, yeah. And then we just had to like do like a dumb, silly show.
That's, wow. I can't imagine what that must have been. I mean, like as a on the outside of that world, not being involved in the sketch side of it and having to write something that comments on that, it was already overwhelming. You know, I was in a field office for the Clinton campaign in Las Vegas when we watched those numbers come in. So it was just, it feels like it was a very traumatic feeling, but now you have to use comedy to sort of heal the nation. And I think SNL really rose back. I mean, it had the highest ratings in what, 40 years for that season specifically. What do you think about now, comedy as this voice of almost the resistance? There is the voice of the resistance, but now there's comedy almost in parallel with it as this as a renewed agency of calling out the government.
It's definitely good at pointing out hypocrisy and idiocracy and all that stuff, but it seems like it's also making us a little bit more divided, because it's pretty much, if you laugh at, like, by, you were only like, people are only watching Colbert if they like agree with his politics now. Like, people aren't, it used to be that everyone across the political spectrum would watch Leno and Letterman and everything, and then they could maybe have their opinions changed based on jokes and whatnot. But it seems more like it's, comedy is doubling down for the people who already agree that Trump sucks. That it's more just exposing everything in that world.
Yeah. Do you think that Twitter is helping or hurting that?
I guess hurting. It really is a nightmare world, but I can't get away from it. It's so good.
I know. The hot takes. I remember texting you in the Covfefe night. What a beautiful night that was for Twitter.
I also knew that night that it was not going to last, because the second that we woke up, like, all the news channels and the adults were going to get involved. But for like a sweet 3 hours, I remember just being on my laptop like, ha, 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 the president's crazy.
Yeah, everything we could have said was just best time.
Like, because, yeah, because it happens so often, like, he would just say something, like, everyone would go to town on it. But then it's almost like Trump is like challenging social media, like, okay, fine, I'm going to say this stupid shit. And then we just have to constantly try to one-up ourselves and him.
Yeah.
Like, he's the president of Twitter more so than he is the United States.
Truly. Yeah. He's good at escalating. Like, he, like, found a game and he's heightening. Like, he's, like, he's just true. He's a, it's insane. But I don't think that anyone's mind has ever been changed on Twitter. Like, no one's ever seen, like, I've never seen a conservative meme and been like, you know what, that is a good point. You just like go like, ah, oh, what a dumb troll.
Yeah.
And they probably do the same thing. Like, they don't see Patton Oswalt's tweets and go, well, you know, he makes a fine point. Like, we're just yelling it for each other.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Do you think there is a point that we can reach where we regain that status, where there is a ability to reach across? Because that's an interesting point that you made about like Colbert and late night, about how you tune in to sort of hear your own opinions back, and it wasn't necessarily the case. Like, Johnny Carson didn't suffer from this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And is there a point to where we get people to laugh at themselves in this climate? I mean, where does it break, or does it keep going?
Because it does seem like comedy has a liberal bias. Yeah. Just in the sense that,
well,
like,
so does truth and fact.
We'll
be right back. Callers.
But you think about it, like the Colberts, you know, and Jon Stewart when he was on, you've got Trevor Noah now. And, you know, like, Fallon has started, you know, after the whole fiasco with him rubbing Trump's head.
Sure.
He had to kind of curve back and like kind of appease everyone, because everyone was pissed about that. And so it's like, yeah, like, you don't hear about conservative comedians.
I did another podcast just about that exact topic, and one of the conclusions we found out was, one, that it just like facts are usually on the side of and like just smarter people tend to be on the left. And the other thing is that comedy is so hard. It's so hard to make it in comedy. Like, it's just like the margins are so slim between who makes it and who doesn't that you have to be in like LA or New York or Chicago to like be a successful comedian. And those cities are just liberal. Mm-hmm. So you're never just going to like imagine someone going to like the Comedy Store and doing a set like bashing Hillary Clinton. They'd be like booed out of there. Yeah, like, or like doing like a UCB show about how like about pro gun rights. Like, it just, you'd never. So just by the virtue of being in cities, and that's where you need to make it in comedy, that's probably why there's no conservative comedian. Also, they're stupid.
Yeah.
Also, they just don't have the brain.
Right. I can't imagine people doing bits about, like, you know, homophobia and, like, and even, like, yeah, to, like, using tragedies, like, you know, like the school shootings. Like, you know, you can't just, and there's an art to that, you know, like taking some current event, but not, you know, politicizing it in a way that makes your audience uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, like, and how do you do that? Like, you know, you're making a set and, you know, sometimes people are coming to you after, right after these events, and they want to laugh, but they're kind of also expecting, like, hey, there's a big thing that happened. Are you going to say something about it?
And you have to. Like, if you were, if you have a late night show and you don't talk about the shooting, like, it seems like weirdly purposeful.
Yeah.
Like,
do you feel pressured to, I think about that all the time doing, like, if I have to do a set. Because I don't usually, I like to talk about politics, but I don't like to talk about necessarily the most current thing. Do you feel pressured when you do a show to talk about what's right now?
I don't do any topical material.
Yeah.
On for stand up, just because I feel like you run out of, you like the shelf life is like 3 days now. Yeah. That if you write a great joke, I feel like that's what Twitter is for. Twitter is for like responding to like what's happening now. But doing it live, unless you have like a daily show or something like that, feels like counterproductive to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is weird. I remember I did a show the night of the like Las Vegas shooting, and I was like, so like hundreds of people just had their lives taken or ruined, and now you got to go up and be like, one time I slipped. Like, it just does, it feels so disingenuine. Mm-hmm. That I think when the tragedies are big enough, it's like doing comedy the night of 9/11. Like, you can't not talk about it,
right? And which SNL famously came back to do, right?
Yeah,
they were
the first live broadcast of any of that magnitude. Because what happened on Tuesday, and then SNL aired that Saturday night.
Yeah,
it was
and
the
they
first
had
thing.
That sketch where Farley and Sandler played the Twin Towers, and it was just very insensitive.
Jesus Christ! Wow. So, you know, we were talking about this before with, being divisive on Twitter, and I have to bring up the Chelsea Clinton moment.
All right,
fine. I just want to talk about it.
All right.
So you tweeted I think this is amazing because this is not who you are at all.
Oh, no.
And you tweeted the thing about, which I thought was hilarious. And so many people on Twitter said this about the kid at the State of the Union that looked like Barron was recast, which is a very funny tweet.
And not at all rude to Barron.
Not rude. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tons of people tweeted this out, and then you tweeted it, and Chelsea Clinton highlighted it and said, we shouldn't bring children into this. And then Donald Trump Jr. was tweeted and said, agreed. So for a brief moment, Zach, you brought the Trumps and Clintons into agreement.
I united a country.
You united
me.
A country.
There was whole articles that were like Chelsea and Trump Jr. share a sweet moment, like bashing this troll online. And it was just like, there was like a dozen articles of professional journalists being paid to write about this, like Chelsea Clinton misinterpreting a tweet. It's so stupid.
Yeah.
But it was one, the tweet was so unoriginal because I tweeted it and so many other people were tweeting it, that exact same joke at the same time that the word Barron was trending, because so many people were tweeting that exact joke.
Yeah.
Jess Dweck had a way better version of the joke that got like 150,000 likes and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, Chelsea just bing, there was like, I'm gonna fuck with this guy. And Chelsea Clinton has such an incredible platform to do so many things.
Yeah.
She could go after any issue. She has people will, apparently journalists will cover her every tweet regardless of content, and her only issue that she ever seems to care about is people attacking Barron. That's like the only thing she cares about.
Yeah.
And it's just like, pick an issue that matters. Like,
well, I feel like she probably sympathizes because she was that kid. I mean, she wasn't as young as Baron, but like she was that kid under the microscope, especially under the whole like Monica Lewinsky thing, like, you know, back then. So I get her like probably being defensive about a kid in the office.
Sure. Yeah, but you just said it's a kid that looks like another kid.
Right,
like,
right.
That's, you know, what people told me I looked like the problem child for the entirety of my childhood.
Oh my
so
gosh.
Baron, relax.
Wait.
It's going to be okay.
Kids get made fun of. Yeah. Like, and also,
I've never
it
thought
wasn't
that, but I can't forget that now.
What is the problem child?
Problem child was a movie about a troublesome redheaded boy.
It is
sort of my biopic.
It's honestly one of the best 90s movies.
Oh, yeah. Really?
There's a sequel to The Problem Child, too.
Yep.
So it wasn't easy to look like the problem child in elementary school. I will say that. That was a struggle. But yeah, I just think it's... I could not believe that happened.
Yeah, it's just so easy to get mad at someone if you misinterpret something or just like... It was nice. Maybe that's the way to unify the world is to just like throw a couple people under the bus together and like find like some common things to hate, which you would think would be like shooters and like,
yeah. Right. Yeah. Applying it in like an actual
people hacking our democracy and not just like random comedians that you pick out.
So I was wondering. So then do you think, because I think that brings up the whole issue of like the PC culture, right? Mm-hmm. And like, what are things we can talk about? What shouldn't we talk about? And, you know, we have to be, you know, aware of how we're addressing either minority groups, you know, people. There are many different avenues that we need to now be hyper aware of.
Yes.
And, you know, how do we address that in, especially in something like comedy where like it's kind of the golden rule is that like everything's up for parody. You know?
Yeah, I think it's so funny because you get all these like older guys who are now like railing against PC culture, like Seinfeld and like people like that. But I think, I don't know, for some reason, it's just not a problem for me. And I feel like for other people who are in our generation that it's just like we grew up like learning like how not to just like disrespect entire groups of people. And so it's just like easy to like make comedy that's just not disrespecting an entire group of people. So it hasn't been a problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't find it that hard. Some people are like, I feel like Neo. I'm like dodging bullets, not just say like all Mexicans or something. And I'm like, well, just like.
Just don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about one Mexican guy, you know. Just don't make it specific. And then all of a sudden it's not an issue. Like,
yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's so easy to like. I don't know. It's like if it's people who want to generalize and be like, all men do this, all women do that. And those are. That's like what comedy's been for so long, but now you just have to be more specific.
In that, I'm curious now too. That sort of leads into my next question. Where do you think comedy goes from here? What is the next?
Oh, it's done.
It's done. We're all done. But like, where does it? Where do we go? Because now we're in this age of Trump, where everything is so reactionary and everything is moving so fast, and we have to be on Twitter to get, you know, the tweet out right in time. And what's the hot thing? What do you think a post-Trump comedy world looks like? Because they say, you know, punk rock and comedy dominates under Republican administrations.
Oh, is that true?
Because we have something to rail against.
Oh, that's interesting.
What does a post-Trump world look like in comedy?
I don't know.
And
I mean,
punk,
I
if you can
comedy
elaborate.
Was pretty, I thought punk and comedy were pretty good under Obama, too. But I don't know. I think it will be nicer. Like, I don't like doing topical reactionary stuff that's not, like, my forte. I'd rather be talking about other stuff. Like, I remember even on SNL, getting the like silly sketches in that had nothing to do with something in the news was like the best, because there'd be like two or three sketches at most a show that were just like evergreen silliness, like a David Pumpkins or something, or I guess it's tied to Halloween, but still something like that.
So that was like one of the most memorable ones of that season.
That was amazing. And it was like getting sketches on like that were almost better than getting on the like just like calling out the Trump stuff or whatever else is happening in the news.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's being silly is fun. It's like if you can't really tweet non-political, non-topical jokes now. It's just they don't catch as well.
Yeah. Is it that's so interesting. I think cuz comedy has become now this way to almost find out about the news.
Yeah.
But are we becoming oversaturated?
Probably.
Yeah. I mean,
everyone's
point,
a comedian. Everyone has a take on every news story. Yeah. And if you're not in like the first 30 seconds, every every take will have been covered. It's hard to be original.
How do you feel about comedians now becoming sort of more activist-y? Because we talked about Bess Kalb actually on the pre-interview, we call it, because she tweeted out a bunch of stuff about helping fight against the NRA and, and every town.
And she got a lot of coverage for that.
Yeah. So how do you feel about, you know, she is somebody who is written in the political world, but also is a writer for Kimmel. So you could say comedian. How do you feel about comedians now becoming more of an activist? Because I think she's moving in the direction almost more of an activist at this point.
Well, she's still, like, her job is still
comedy. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But what
she's known, also amazing and a wonderful human. We work together at Kimmel.
Yeah.
And
great Twitter.
She does have a very good Twitter. Yeah, I mean, it kind of, there's a lot of overlap between comedy and activism and politics. And I always forget, like, just how similar, like, politics and entertainment is, because it's kind of the same. Kind of the same thing,
mm-hmm.
like just in terms of like you're just trying to reach a broad spectrum of people and like make a point, and like, you know, like stump speeches are essentially like your tight 10 or like whatever, like like in the, you know, and you're like, okay, people didn't like that joke, so I'll like revise it a little bit here. Okay, they responded to that, so I'll adjust it a little bit here. Like, there's a lot of overlap, and I think comedians have a big platform, so you can use that platform to respond to big things happening in the world, and that's a very good way to be active. And also it also makes us feel less useless, because a lot of times you write comedy and you're like, man, I just wish, like, I'm like yelling about all these things, but I feel like I'm not actually affecting any change. But to actually like be like, wait, I actually have a lot of people who are listening to what I'm saying right now, so if I can use that microphone to like actually do some good, or like change someone's mind, or like bring attention to something that actually is a practical use of it. And it makes it feel like you got into comedy for a reason.
Yeah.
Not just to help yourself. You got into it because you want to say something about the world.
I feel like that's what Chappelle did when he came back for that episode. Like, it felt very profound. Like, he was like, yeah, this is my return, but like something big just happened. All right,
yeah.
Let's let's move on. Let's get ourselves back together. We kind of knew this was going to happen. So let's just keep pushing forward.
Yeah.
I think, and we can probably close on this, but do you have any recommendations for, we always ask when we bring people on, recommendations if they're getting into activism or they want to get into this line of work. Do you have a recommendation for somebody out there that might want to be getting into comedy and might want to use it as an avenue for change?
I think just don't at this point. There's so many of us. It's just, you're not helping anyone. No, I think it's good. I mean, there's definitely more places that you can do comedy than ever before. There's just like more like...
Mm-hmm.
websites and that like have like high budget stuff and like things like that, but I don't know what to get involved. Tweet all the time is good. Do every show that you can, make your own stuff, which is like, because there's no like, you can make a sketch online that's about like some kind of activist topic that's also comedy, and no, you don't need any gatekeeper. You can just put it online and it could go viral and you could like affect the national conversation.
Yeah.
Like that's like kind of like the American dream is kind of like baked into Reddit now. If you just like go big on that or something, like
really?
You can still. So, I mean, just doing it and like having a take and also trying to be original, that like before you make something, you like go check to see if like 10 other comedians have already done it. Cause that, it's so hard to find an original take these days just because there's so many comedians responding to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Hire me. Just hire Nick.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and me too.
And James too.
Oh, yeah.
James is very funny.
James.
Right here.
Well,
oh, sorry.
Zach, thank you for coming on. We wanted to have you on for a while, and it's so nice to chat with you about your experience and your ongoing life within this world, and we really appreciate it.
Oh yeah, I'm so glad your Zoom is working.
I am too. What if it wasn't recording?
Are you still for Bernie, even though he's a Russian pawn?
Oh my god! What? Of course. Why did
we kind of talked
shirt.
About?
We talked about it. I am wearing a Bernie for President T-shirt currently.
Yes.
I only voted for Bernie in the primaries because of the Russian propaganda that I saw, not because
you were my
of
only
his
friend who did that. Actually,
yeah.
I think he might be compromised.
It's so rude people online saying, like, you only voted for Bernie because of, like, all the Russian propaganda. Like, there's no way to just, like, go and look up everything he said for the last 30 years yeah. and be like, you know what? I think these are good thoughts.
Yeah. Oh, Bernie.
Well, we are not Russian bots, so you can follow us
beep, beep,
at We Rebel Podcast on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And then if you want to send us an email, werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep. And where we rebel on Apple Podcasts, give us a rating, give us a comment. We like them and we appreciate them. Zach, do you want to plug your social media?
Yeah, at Zach Bornstein. That's ZACKBORNSTEIN. There's Instagram. There's Twitter. That's the best one.
Twitter's the best
one.
And then
Facebook, you can also do. There's I used to have a live journal.
Do you have a page on Facebook?
I don't have a, or no, I do, but I don't promote it at all because I got verified, but they verified my like, just like self rather than the page. They like made a mistake. So I just like, I'm like, I may as well just.
Yeah. Just rock and roll.
Facebook
with that.
Makes no mistakes, just propaganda.
Yeah. It's crazy that was, they like created a tool to like rank how hot women are at Harvard and then ended up like undermining our entire democracy. That was like, one dude was like, is Chelsea or Ashley hotter? And then now it's like, I'm so sorry. We have installed a dictator in the most powerful country in the world.
Oh man,
that is so funny.
I love that. Oh, I have to I literally have to go to work right now.
All right,
everyone, have a great week.
Have a great week.
We'll see you next week.
Maybe enjoy your onions.
Who knows? Bye.
Bye.
Campfire.
Hey, this is Patrick.
And this is Mark, co-hosts of Nintendo Cartridge Society.
Join us every week as we talk about all things Nintendo.
The latest Nintendo news.
The oldest Nintendo news.
Games you used to love.
And games you used to hate.
Everything Nintendo.
That's every Tuesday. Join us on Nintendo Cartridge Society.